Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 7 of season 2 of The Matchup, a storytelling podcast from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where you, the listener, gets to decide who told the most compelling story. I'm your host, Jason, and today with me, I have the Reverend Lucy Strandlin. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Jason.
How you doing?
I'm so good.
You seem like it. And joining us for the first pairing, I think, ever, we have Dr. Mark Audrey Graves. Hello, Mark.
Hi, everybody.
How's everybody feeling this afternoon?
Punchy.
Punchy.
Yep.
Good.
We are recording this in the week before our bishop visit, which is the week before
Holy Week.
So I'm doing great.
It is kind of a in the weeds type time period, I think, for us all. And we have a really long day tomorrow, which is a little tricky.
Hadn't even gotten that far.
You know,
but we're here now.
Yeah,
it's going to be a
today.
Great podcast. Awesome. And we're so glad you're listening. Mm-hmm. It's going to be great.
We have what I would call a deep, deep dive episode today.
Yeah.
We are taking it way back. Today we are covering, it's a mouthful, the least known important event in Middle Age church history. Da, da, da.
Da.
Mark.
In terms of the medieval era, right?
Yeah.
Like, not middle age. Like
there are, right.
That, how Mark and I are. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Not, yeah. Not where you are in your lifespan, but in
not
terms
going
of...
to buy a convertible, but...
yeah. Mark.
Yes.
This really feels like it would be in your wheelhouse.
I mean, I have been known to describe myself to people as a medievalist.
Okay.
So, great.
Disclaimer, in the words, if I may quote Austin Powers... Nerd alert.
And Lucy, you are brave enough to take Mark on this episode. Yeah, I really appreciate that.
Brave or just, you know, willfully, I don't know.
Hey, you know, there's weeds and then there's weeds. Let's just get into some weeds.
Did you struggle at all with your pick?
Well, no. Not initially. I had an immediate idea. But then as I was fleshing out that idea, I realized... The idea I had was really more like at the very end of this time period and going into the next time period. So I had to do a little bit of a last minute pivot.
Okay.
But I'm using some of the same content. And I'm not going to tell you what I was going to do because maybe I'll save it for another one.
Absolutely.
Jason, how did you pick this topic?
You know, we are doing a church history sort of theme.
Series?
So we did two episodes of church themes. So. Mm-hmm. And this one is that one.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay. You know what? We're just gonna jump in.
Great.
It is time for our two guests to present their cases. We will talk a little about it, and after the episode, you listeners get to vote on who told the most compelling story. Dr. Mark, would you like to start us off?
I would be happy to.
Thank you.
Should we like define the term first and talk about what?
Yeah.
What is the middle age time period? Or
yeah, let's do it.
I mean, right. I mean, I'm recalling. I think your prompt kind of helped me kind of contextualize the frame. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you kind of said between the fall of the Western Roman Empire and the early 400 and whatever, and the beginning of the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah, I think it was something like that. It was like the start of the Reformation.
Yeah.
I think.
So like between, 500 and 1500 or something.
Yeah.
So a cool 1,000 years to dig into.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes the ending point is talked about as Reformation, which is sort of 1517, if you want to put a year on it.
Right.
And then sometimes, like, the Renaissance is sort of thought of as
When does that start?
Yeah, and when does that start?
Right. And is that a time period or a philosophical movement? Or, how do we define that?
Yeah.
That's another episode, right?
Yep.
So roughly 500 to 1500 is the, just a cool 1,000 years of history. Yeah. That we're
people talk about, like, the fall of Constantinople.
Right.
So, given that time frame.
Yep.
I thought about discussing Dionysius Exiguus, who,
of course you did,
in the year 525, developed the AD Anno Domini calendar that we still use today.
Well, that's interesting.
But no.
Not.
Oh.
No. I thought about the year 1135, when Bishop Suger of Paris laid the cornerstone of the Basilica of Saint-Denis, which began the phenomenon of Gothic architecture.
Yeah.
But no. I thought about talking about Gerard of Cremona, who died in the year 1187, who founded the Toledo School of Translators, who made the first translations into Latin of the works of Aristotle, which found their way into the hands of John Wycliffe, who influenced Jan Hus, who influenced Martin Luther, and thus directly led to the Protestant Reformation. But no. Instead, I decided that the least known but most important event in medieval church history concerns a monk by the name of, he's got a great name, Guido d'Arezzo.
Okay.
Has anybody ever heard of Guido d'Arezzo? Can't I hope not, because it's least known. He was a Benedictine monk, and because we've got to have a good Conan O'Brien reference.
Okay.
In the year 1000, right around the year 1000, yep. He was born somewhere around the year 1090 and died. Nobody knows when he died, because he became a hermit and retreated to a monastery in the 1030s. So he died sometime after 1033. And because he was a hermit in a monastery, his death is not recorded for posterity. But here's what he did, and here's why. It's very important, even though it's not very well known. He invented staff notation for writing music.
Oh, interesting.
So,
that's cool.
This was not intentional, but it just happened this way. I wrote my little notes on music paper.
Oh, listeners, I really wish
you
could
beautiful.
See this.
Yeah, and we have Guido d'Arezzo to thank for this system of little lines, horizontal parallel with each other, five lines. The system he invented had four lines instead of five, but it's okay. The same thing. I'm taking a picture here. The reason why I was like, oh, this is it, because this really is church history.
Mm.
Because he did all of the stuff for music so that it would be as a teaching aid for monks and nuns and clergy and people singing in church for singing the liturgy. The whole point was to sing at the daily offices and at the Mass and everything else. And he devised it to be a teaching aid, to learn all the bodies of chants that needed to be sung. There was notation before he came along for about the past maybe 200 some years before he was there. They had developed notation, but it was just little squiggly marks, like little lines and dots and things that were written above the words that basically served as a memory aid for that kind of the shaping the outline of how the chant went. But it wasn't plotted on a graph at all. It was just, you'd have the words of the hymn or the psalm or whatever, and above each word there'd be a little, almost like if you've ever seen in a Hebrew language Bible, that there's the words and then there's little like lines and things. There's the vowel markings, but then sometimes there's other lines, and that's the little cantillation for how they chant the Hebrew scriptures, like in synagogue. And the early notation was like that, just little squiggly lines that people are still deciphering. And they can largely decipher them because of the later notation that is a concordance with it. But on its own, it's just like, what is this? And it was just meant to be like a visual memory aid. And so he said, and at that time in the early, around the year 1000, They said that it took about 10 years for a person training to learn. Because they had to memorize all these chants for the different daily offices and for the Mass, the seasons of the year, all of these things. The services were sung. They were chanted. And so it took somebody 10 years to memorize all the melodies and all the hymns and everything. And they just learned it by rote, by doing it and memorizing it. And these little, you know, starting around the year 800, they had these little kind of memory aids on paper, but they weren't specific. You couldn't tell what a note was. You could just tell how it related to its neighbors around it. So Guido d'Arezzo, and he was a pretty young guy when he did this, like maybe at 18 or so. Nobody knows exactly, but somewhere around the age of 20, he devised this system where he said, hey, if I draw a line across the page and then plant these little shapes, were called neumes, and he said, if I can place these neumes on this graph, then that I can say, well, this line always stands for the same note. And therefore, if you know what the starting note is and you know how the pattern works, where every line is a third apart in a scale from the other notes, then you don't have to take 10 years to just memorize all the chants. You can see them on the page, and once you've learned how to read with the system of writing it down, you can sight read and learn the and figure out how to sing the chant just by looking at it. And so the claim was that it went from being a 10-year process to a 1 or 2 year process to train to be a cantor or a singing person for the church services. Along with that, he's also the person in the same system who invented the system that we call solfège. Now, that word may not be of any meaning to most of our listeners, but you know what it is if you've ever seen The Sound of Music. And the song that Sister Maria teaches the kids, Doe a Deer, a female deer, he invented that too.
Wow.
And this is what I think is so cool about how he did that. So in his system, it wasn't Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do. The first syllable was Oot, and it later got changed to Do because they said, well, Do is easier to sing than Oot, and it ends in a vowel, and all the other ones end in a vowel. But the reason it was Oot instead of Do was because he took a hymn that each phrase of the hymn started on the next note of the scale. And so he took the first syllable of the of each line of the poem of the hymn and made the first syllable of that word that was sung on that note the name for that note. So
I'm picturing him like in a montage with a bunch of other monks.
Yeah.
Whose robes are made out of curtains and they're singing songs.
They're in the hills.
And they're dancing.
I mean, he did live in Tuscany, so there's some hills they could have been, you know, spinning around in.
That's funny.
But the hymn was for the feast of the Nativity of John the Baptist.
Okay.
In June. And it's the in Latin the hymn is Ut queant laxis, and I've got it here. What the translation is, and this is cool because the translation, when you think about the musical scale, and this is the hymn text he used to have the names of the notes, is so that your servants may with loosened voices resound the wonders of your deeds, clean the guilt from our stained lips, O Saint John. So the hymn itself is talking about singing with your mouth, you know, and loosening your voice to sing. And so you've got ut is the very first word, which means thus or so in Latin. And then the next phrase, and that begins on, like, let's say that begins on the note C.
Yeah.
And remember, ut is the same as do.
Yeah.
And then the second phrase of the verse begins with resonare. And so the first syllable is re of that word. And that begins on D. And then the next phrase begins with the word mira. First syllable is mi, and that begins on an E, and you see the pattern here. And then famuli with fa, and then solve with so, and then labii with la. Now there's no T or C because this scale only had six notes. That seventh note doesn't even appear in the hymn. It got added later, also when they wanted to complete that seven note scale to go all the way up. But that basic system with those syllables meant that, along with having the written notation, a person learning how to read music and learning how to sing these hymns could then figure out, even if they had never seen this hymn before or heard it, once they learned this system of reading it, they could figure out how the tune went and thus learn a lot more new music in a short period of time in order to sing all the liturgy stuff. Here's what's interesting. No good deed goes unpunished. So he was this young monk at a monastery who invented this system and started using it to teach the novices and all the, you know, people coming in. And the abbot at the monastery got very jealous and very resentful. And because there are always people, remember this is church.
There's always haters.
It's change and it's new.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to be suspicious of anything that is different and new, and you're changing what the way we've always done it. So he actually had to leave that monastery.
Wow.
And was actually invited to go back to his hometown by the bishop of the cathedral. This is Arezzo, which is in northern Italy. And the bishop of the cathedral invited him to come and teach the choir this new system of writing music, so he could then teach the hymns to the choir at the cathedral. And then he, from there, his fame spread and the system got, the word got out about this thing. And he was then invited by the Pope to go to Rome to teach the Vatican choir, Sistine Chapel choir. In those days, it wasn't the Sistine Chapel the way we know it now, but it was, you know, still the papal choir. And he taught all the clergy in Rome this system of writing music with the syllables, you know, ray of drop of golden sun, and all the rest.
I would have never guessed that song has medieval origins.
It does, in the church. And from there, and then he wrote it down. He wrote, there are four things that he wrote that survive. That all have to do with music and specifically this system and the stuff around it. He wrote a treatise on rhythm and all this other stuff between about the year 1025. And the reason we know he died after 1033 was that was the last piece that he wrote that has a date in it.
Mm.
And so these four written treatises that he wrote about music then spread all over Europe. And within 50 years, this system was being adopted by everybody.
Wow.
And so we think about both within the church now, you know, every Sunday morning we go and we pick up a hymnal and open it up. And again, even for those of us who are, you know, not didn't learn how to read music as kids or whatever, you can still see the music on the page and say, I can see a pattern of how the notes go up and down and the shape of the melody can kind of, you know, you can kind of see how that works. But you know, we hopefully all of us, at least to a little degree, as kids in school, were introduced to how to read music and have that sense of this is how this all works. And, you know, everything else, we would not have any of the stuff we have from, you know, that point forward in terms of writing music down.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the great composers writing their music that we have, you know, jazz musicians use this getting into the 20th century, you know, pop music, charts, all this stuff, you know, chord symbols, you know, anything that involves learning music from a piece of paper rather than just hearing somebody else doing it and remembering it. That's Guido d'Arezzo in the early 1000s.
Wow. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome.
That was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have never guessed.
I think Oot a deer doesn't have quite the same.
Not quite. So that got changed. There was a guy named Giovanni. I had to look this up. It's like Giovanni Doni was his name in the 1600s. Changed it partly to say, well, he said, yeah, it's easier to sing.
Yeah.
And all the other ones end in a vowel, so we should have this one end in a vowel.
Mm.
It just so happens that his last name is Doni. He claimed, he said, well, Do is the first syllable of the word Dominus, which means Lord in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
But it also is the first syllable of his own name, Doni, putting his stamp on the thing.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. I would have never. Did you know that?
No.
No.
Little known. Yeah. Least known. Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome.
Lucy, you going to tell us some interesting song facts, too?
Some song facts.
Okay.
Mark's presentation just really feeds very well into mine.
Good.
When you started out, you named like several things that happened around the year 1000, 1100 that were breakthroughs, I guess you could say, in knowledge. And I can't remember all the examples you said, but as you were naming them, I was like, this works. Okay. So kind of my starting point is oftentimes when we hear the Middle Ages, we think of like, sometimes referred to as the Dark Ages or a time of ignorance when people were sort of waiting in ignorance for the light of the Reformation or the light of the Renaissance, when, you know, Reformation, when there was great change within the church, and Renaissance, when we think of this like flourishing of art and music and all kinds of things. But that's a gross generalization and actually just not true in a lot of ways, particularly when we get to about the year 1000 and this like latter part of the Middle Ages. So like 1000, 1100 to 1500s was this really rich time of learning, specifically like the pursuit of knowledge. I just want to acknowledge, like, yes, the Middle Ages were a difficult time in a lot of ways. You know, plague and violence, the Crusades, corruption in a lot of ways. Yes, to acknowledge all of that. And it can also be true at the same time that it was a time of flourishing of knowledge. And part of that was an interchange with other parts of the world. And I'm kind of speaking to Western Europe because that's sort of the kind of tradition that our particular denomination comes out of. But part of what contributed to the richness of this time was an interchange of ideas with other regions, particularly the area of the world that was predominantly Muslim. So there was an interchange of ideas that really affected some of the kind of pillars of our theological tradition. So if you think about Thomas Aquinas, guys like him were drawing a lot from that area and had a lot of respect for the Arab world and the scholarship that was happening there. So sometimes we just kind of think about Europe and forget, you know, the richness of the rest of the world. But even if we just think about Europe, looking at our own sort of like denomination's history, that there was still this like super important interchange of ideas. Some of the things that happened in this time that I'm kind of building towards were the beginning of like cathedrals at, being placed in large cities and having schools attached. So if you think about like pre-1000, there were not colleges or universities. Like it really started out as cathedrals with schools, and then that built into universities. So places like Oxford and Cambridge founded around 1209. If you look at Oxford's website, they have evidence of learning happening in like 10, like 1000 something. So I feel like those two places are always competing. But Cambridge founded in 1209. University of Paris was around the same time. All of these places, theology was a big focus of study. If you go kind of other regions, places like Salerno was another big university that was known more for medicine because of its proximity, sort of a shared border area with the Muslim world. But these kind of found these places like foundational places for theology. The thing that's exciting to me as, you know, a Episcopalian in the, what year are we in? 2024. is that theology being taken seriously as a field of study that was not afraid of questioning, of inquiry, of asking hard questions, considering contradictions. We might think of like medieval age and just think of, you know, I don't know what kind of comes to mind for you when you think of that time period. You may not think about asking really tough questions about faith and trying to answer them with reasoned argument and kind of taking step by step, going through an argument to build with evidence and taking into account objections and counter arguments and sort of building a sense of like who God is and what God is like. That is a just sort of a defining characteristic of the scholarship of this time period, which I think is helpful for us to remember that, one, that's okay. It's okay to question our faith, to like acknowledge the counter arguments and then to answer them and to sort of build a sense of who we believe God to be out of those questions. Like that, that is a valid way to proceed as a person of faith. And not only is it valid, it has a long, rich tradition within our church and beyond it. So this movement was called, or is called, Scholasticism. And some of those major figures are like Peter Lombard, who was the theologian who Martin Luther most engaged with in his writing, which was in the 1500s. Thomas Aquinas, who I touched on, his model is like, if you study him in school, you get, it's so dense. I mean, if you ever read the Summa, is very dense, and it you have to work through it piece by piece. But the way that he talks about theology is through like a question and answer form, basically. Mm. So it might be like about the existence of God, like is God real, basically. And then he goes through like the very first thing he names is like arguments against the existence of, like, here are all the reasons why one might make a case that like we can't know that God exists or God doesn't exist. And then it's like, but, and then kind of has a counter argument. And then he will respond to each of those objections and then kind of come to a conclusion. So it's this very reasoned walk through building a theological argument. And for me, it was really important in seminary to learn that, because sometimes when someone questions your faith or something that you believe, or says something is true that you grew up believing is not true, from scripture, or you were taught this in church, our first response is to have this gut reaction and just say, well, you're wrong, you know? And I don't know why, but you're wrong. And just not have like a reasoned argument. And so in seminary, we really learned, my professor called it having a hospitable intellect. Mm. Basically like hearing that person's like, okay, where are you coming from? Like how did you arrive at that? And then just sort of working through piece by piece, responding to it. I mean, if you choose to engage with somebody, which isn't always wise to do, but if someone wants to have a theological conversation back and forth, learning how to talk about your faith with reason and sort of build like how I got here. Yeah. Here's what backs that up. Here's what I see out in the world, or here's what I read in scripture. It wasn't always scriptural. It was sometimes like experience, you know, things that you observe about the natural world. So I found that really helpful when I find myself kind of that feeling in my stomach of like, oh, you're questioning something like deeply held in me. It causes me to kind of say, hang on, like what, why am I responding that way? Mm. Like what exactly is it that I'm disagreeing with, or is like, you know, kind of getting a rise out of me, and helps me to sort of go back to like, okay, I believe this to be true and this to be true. And if those things are true, then this is true. That's Thomas. Like that is kind of a legacy we have from this time period of thinking about theology kind of as a science or as a science, that reasoned argumentation. Anselm of Canterbury is another one, like logical, trackable arguments for God's existence. Just a different way of thinking about it and engaging these concepts and really like working through them. So universities were a place to organize ideas, to use reason and logic to talk about God and God's existence. And such that like this kind of time period, there's sort of like an idea of a 12th century Renaissance. Like there was reform happening within the monastic tradition. There was learning happening. There was new emphasis on learning and training that, you know, it wasn't like there was this long period of time where all that was on hold until the Reformation. There was reform happening. There was like little renaissances happening that it wasn't all just like on hold until we get to those times that we like capital R Reformation or capital R Renaissance. And one figure who is really fascinating to look at, and this to kind of fits within this tradition, is Hildegard of Bingen, who was an incredible person. I mean, she just did everything, basically. She lived, we think, from 1098 to 1179, was a monastic mystic in the Benedictine tradition, a composer, so I am talking a little bit about music, wrote liturgical texts, settings for mass, commentaries on the Gospels, and even treatises on health, especially women's reproductive health and the natural world, medicine, and in more recent times, I think under the recent Pope Benedict, was made a doctor of the church, which is a title reserved for very few, like there's like 10 or 12 doctors of the church, and it's people like Augustine and Gregory the Great. Hildegard is one of those. And there are a lot of ways to engage her work. She had these visions that she wrote down and shared, visions about relationship between God and humanity, of the Trinity. Again, sort of putting these like concepts, kind of putting more thought and substance around them that you can like learn more about them. And one of the concepts that she's known for that I love is called Veriditas. Is that how you would pronounce it? Veriditas? It's like the greening.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like so like the straight the like direct translation is greening.
Right.
And she uses it in different ways, but talks about it as like part of the divine nature, part of the nature of God is this greening. Like we can observe it. It's an observable thing we can see in creation, this flourishing, this growth. But that's part of like who God is and who God made us to be, this like flourishing, that we were made for flourishing, creation was made for flourishing, and like part of who God is like that sort of creative, abundant nature, which is so cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I find this like really helpful for us now too. Like when we think about that time and all the parts of that era that were wrong and challenging and all the stuff that was not good. But it's like you can look and find these points of light and growth and knowledge and like a hunger for understanding and knowledge that we really, I mean, our like systematic theology within our tradition is basically based on these scholars I've named, like Thomas and Anselm. And so how important that time was, but also a good reminder to us, like in our day and age, that even when things feel like we're sliding back or however you kind of see this time of like, it's easy to see all the bad stuff that's happening. There is always a response to that, I think, like because of who we're made to be of like this, okay, well, no, but hang on. Like, you know, people will continue to try to like grow and this greening, this like flourishing is what God wants. Like that is what God wants for us. That's who God is. That's what creation was made to do and how, you know, even in times that feel like they're a difficult era of time in history, look to the people who are doing something new and contributing to like growth and understanding. And so I don't have a specific event, but it's more like that kind of
a concept
year, or, you know, or let's say 1100, 1200, that sort of 12th century Renaissance that I refer to as like, there was something blossoming during this time that we still rely on. And I think part of like what you're talking about is Mark's story is a part of that too.
Yeah. This intellectual inquiry and curiosity and invention. And,
yeah. Yeah. We both joked about talking about the rise in the use of flying buttresses as being our answer, which is like an architectural element of cathedrals that allows the cathedral to have like a vaulted ceiling like that, like that
big windows.
And that it draws your eye up and gives you this sense of scale and space and like draws your thoughts, hopefully, and heart up to God. And if you think about the building of cathedrals becoming this place of learning and community and where people come together, and then there are schools attached, and then that, you know, develops into universities, and then what universities offer. Like, just when you think about that building upon building,
that's true.
Pun intended.
Yeah. Well, and talk about a little known, like this whole notion of a 12th century Renaissance, like talk about a little known event.
Yeah.
And I just think like, you know, would we be so lucky that 900 years from now, people look back on our day and think like those kindly of it, and you know, those benighted 21st
like
century
the dumb
people.
Ages. Like, what? We're the dumb ages?
I mean, and you can't, you know, flying buttresses, like, you cannot go to, you know, Sainte-Chapelle in Paris or Salisbury Cathedral or, you know, name your cathedral, the, you know, Cologne. You cannot see these structures and think, gosh, these buildings were built by uneducated, ignorant people. Like, you know, it's just, there's no...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and even just the foresight to, like... I mean, the thing that's really moving to me about the building of cathedrals is, like, the people who start them are probably not going to be the ones who see them completed.
Yeah.
And so beginning the building of something that you won't really get to see in your lifetime here on Earth, but trusting that it will come together and it will be this beautiful... you know, witness to God and something that inspires people for generations to come. Like, that is so cool. That's so selfless. And like, you know, when we want to create generational change or, you know, want to begin a new way of being together in the world, like that's such a good metaphor of start the work.
Yeah.
Trust that others will carry it on. Yeah. And even if you don't see the exact fruits of it in your lifetime, like you're building something, which is really cool.
Thank you, Izzy.
Welcome.
That was great.
I feel like I never like directly answer the question.
Hey, you pointed to something. No, I think you did answer the question.
Yeah.
Okay.
I
mean, good.
You know. Yeah. Because I mean, it's a little bit unfair because my topic got
used as evidence
into yours. That's actually very clever, though. That's a way to win an argument right there.
It's a lot of this is due to my church history professor in seminary, who really helped us like kind of get a better sense of what this time period was like and how much we owe for all its flaws and you know, things that we don't want to duplicate, how much was born in this time that we are built upon.
Mm-hmm.
And in an era when Christianity is, there are plenty of voices saying, don't question it, just believe.
That's kind
of
where I'm thinking.
That is not at all our like history with this.
Right.
It's like, yeah, ask the questions, work them out. Look at them, take them apart. Look at them step by step, like work through them. That is actually the faithful thing to do. That's a faithful exercise. And like it's a science, which is kind of cool.
I think it's really cool. And I think you're right that like, some people are scared by that idea of thinking critically about their faith and things they believe. So, yeah, thank you.
Which is like if you, that feels like an insecure place to be. Like yeah. Or if it can't stand a little like looking into, taking a closer look. Like yeah. How, don't you want it to be a little stronger than that?
Right, exactly. Well, thank you both of you.
Yeah.
It was good. I liked it. It wasn't as dense as I was scared it was going to be. But we talked about Sound of Music. I mean,
yeah. I don't think it was as dense as we could have gone.
Yeah.
Well, I could have broken out actual Thomas Aquinas quotes, but I didn't.
Yeah. Or if you've ever read any of Hildegard's stuff, it's also pretty dense.
Yeah. Would you, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if there's a piece of music that you would hope people would listen to of hers.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah.
I was thinking my college roommate is not a religious person, but she took a sacred music class and loved the Columba Aspect. I don't know.
The Dove. It's an antiphon.
Yeah, and she would play that in our room over and over. It was beautiful. So it spoke to her even as someone who was not a churchy person.
Yeah, Hildegard was so, she wrote, I mean, you can find like albums and recordings of her antiphons and her music, you know, and they're just gorgeous. There's a group, I can recommend an ensemble that sings her music called Sequentia.
Okay.
That just do it such justice. It's haunting music. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cool thing about Hildegard is she essentially broke the rules.
Okay.
You know, there were set rules for how these things were to be done in terms of like Guido d'Arezzo and his system with the scales and everything. And what she did was she didn't break the rules, but she bent them to expand. So her music goes beyond the scale
and
uses more intervals. And that's part of its beauty and its charm is how it bends those rules. She wrote the first liturgical play that has music. And it's a morality play about the virtues and the devil. And it was she wrote it to be performed at her abbey with the nuns. And the character of the devil doesn't sing. He speaks because music is a gift of God.
That's funny.
And so he's the only character who doesn't sing.
Huh.
And the local priest who would come to celebrate the mass for the nuns got roped into playing the part of the devil. And so you have to wonder if she's not like, if there's some subliminal thing that's there. But funny. That's a cool piece of music in of itself that she wrote. But,
very cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both. Friends, the cases have been presented for, what was the exact phrase? Man, it is a long one. The least known important event in Middle Age church history.
Indeed.
And now the power is in your hands. Who was it? Was it Lucy? Or was it Mark? You let us know. If you're listening on Spotify, there is a link to a poll in the episode description. Keep listening and voting. We are getting towards the end of the season. We only have a few more episodes left, which is crazy.
But I'm done.
Yeah,
I've got one more.
Well, please keep listening. New episodes will be released on Thursdays on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please do all the things, rate, like, and subscribe if you enjoy the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening and voting. We'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.